Welcome back to The Regular Journey in the podcast and episode 70. I think that's crazy. Anyway, I am glad you're back and thank you for continuing on the journey with me. Let's see, where did we leave off? I'm at NDU, the IR office is moving along, and we successfully hosted a professional conference to further the implementation of IR as a relatively new aspect of higher education, especially among professional military institutions. It's also becoming pretty important for other professional military education institutions to follow suit because most of them are now in the process of or already received accreditation like NDU did. I also started teaching grad school at UMUC, which is a very engaging experience, and I'm going to start with that. It was challenging, to be sure. Unlike classroom teaching, it was, at least for me, as challenging by engaging with all the students as students have to engage with their peers online. When I moved to teaching PhD students, that was really eye-opening. First, I was surprised how the skill set for writing papers was far less than I expected. In fairness to the students, many were professionals well in their careers, and writing academically is very different from business writing. In addition, technology was firmly rooted in both academia and the professional world, and that has an impact on our ability to write, me included. Having said that, this was a PhD program, and being able to write thoughtful papers was indeed important. I had students all over the world, and they would log in at all hours my time, so I had to learn how to temper my own time in the classroom, especially at first, because otherwise I would be on almost 24/7. Students could schedule office hours, although most times they would just catch me when I was logged in, and that was certainly fine with me. So within the classroom, most students are engaging with each other, with me coming in either to bring the guardrails back or further the discussion. Overall, I'd see that the more engaged students would bring others along differently than in a classroom environment, and there were some very bright students who brought out some extremely wonderful tangents and points for the course. On the other side, I'd have to do a little pushing for those who would otherwise sit in the back of a face-to-face classroom and have them engage a bit more. Even still, everyone did engage at a fair amount, and I really didn't have too much of a problem with students hanging back. A fair percentage of the grade was participation, so it was a chance to help everyone keep that in balance. Now, I've never been a fan of group projects, and while it was recommended to have at least one group project, I would keep them to a bare minimum, because it was even more challenging in an online class with students in many different time zones. Knowing how group projects tend to play out, these projects were relatively a smaller portion of the overall grade than I would normally do in a classroom. And yes, I had the occasional student complaining that one classmate or another was not participating with the group and would complain that they're going to get the same grade for the project. After the first term, I came up with a plan to fix that. The group portion of the project would be the same grade for everyone. And then I required a very short individual paper that would be the individual portion of the project grade. And students seemed to have liked that as well, because those that worked really hard felt they were getting more credit, and those that didn't, well, their grade would reflect appropriately. You may remember that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that one of the factors that I was concerned with, that there would be a chance for cheating with both technology and the course being completely online. After all, you really don't know who is behind the screen. Let me share a story that amplified my concern. I was on a flight to I don't know where, and there was a young woman sitting next to me. We struck up a conversation, and she shared that she was working on a biology graduate paper. Wow, that was cool. And I asked her what her major was. Her response shocked me. She said, oh, I'm not a student. And I'm thinking, then why are you writing a biology paper? So I inquired a bit more, and she said she writes papers for students as a part-time business. Now, I had never heard of this, and maybe I'm just being naive. She sold papers for students across a wide spectrum of disciplines. And as carefully as I could, I kept inquiring because now I was curious. She detected my skepticism and said, look at the ads in the back of magazines like the Rolling Stones. Anyway, she said that she writes mostly for medical students because while they're smart and they can pass the course, they can't afford to get less than an A, and she guarantees an A on all of her papers. I'm still pretty shocked, and I just took it all in. When I got to my destination, I quickly did look at the ads in the back of the Rolling Stones magazine, and yep, there were several ads about selling their wares and writing student papers for a fee. I saw similar ads in other national newspapers. Armed with this information, I was concerned now that I'm teaching online, and UMUC was equally concerned already. They had two programs and provided advice on how to include a warning on the syllabus that plagiarism and cheating would not be tolerated by the university. There were two programs. One was where the students could input their papers to check for possible plagiarism across papers, journals, and published work. The other was a different program that was used by faculty. And it was pretty amazing. I uploaded papers into this program, and I don't recall the name of it. It would give a percentage of similarities to both other graduate papers and more than just at UMUC, as well as published work. It would rate whether it was considered incidental or clearly copied. I taught there for almost a decade, and I will tell you that I had to address possible plagiarism with no less than maybe 3 students a year. Some were clearly blatant, and some were incidental and just required further inquiry. If you're wondering why it included other student papers, it's because plagiarism includes copying others' papers to include your own, because you cannot use your own work for 2 different classes for 2 different grades. And that, of course, makes sense, unless you have explicit permission of a course where it's a graduated course where you build on other papers that you've written. Keep in mind that a lot of my students were working professionals, and some were senior leaders in their respective organizations. And this, in hindsight, still surprises me because they would have papers that were clearly plagiarized. In addition, I would have a student who would contact me just hours before the deadline for the submission of a paper. You know, the typical cat ate my homework excuse. And I would usually just respond with, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. The date of the paper has been known since the beginning of the semester. And did you know that fellow classmate so-and-so was an active duty military member deployed to a remote location and their paper is right on time? Oh, well, I guess procrastination isn't just for young undergrads. Back at NDU, we successfully get funding for a $280,000 data warehouse, which was necessary to house all the data that we identified over the past year for our IR program. It was an interesting venture getting funding at this level, as it wasn't much easier than other levels of demand. You'd think that if you worked for the chairman, it would be a little bit easier. Oh well, it was a lot of money and outside of the normal budget cycle request. With this investment, we're making good progress with new reports to include the first annual report to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And while not the deliberate intent, that type of report was a result of having a data warehouse and analytics that enable these new reports for the chairman as well as all the levels of leadership within NDU, making the university wiser in making long-term and short-term decisions. When the university president works for the chairman, your work gets to the top pretty quick. I was definitely expanding the kinds of opportunities that this assignment brought, and I really enjoyed the breadth of the experience. I was selected as an evaluator for the Asia-Pacific Center for Strategic Studies. Now, NDU had within its components the Africa Center, and for some reason, I don't know why, the Asia Center was separate, and it was located in Honolulu. This was great. A staff trip to Hawaii? Yes, please. It was my first of many trips to Hawaii for both work and pleasure over the next many years. I really do enjoy going there. The center, which is now closed, and I believe a military museum, if I remember correctly from the last time I was in Hawaii, was just up from Waikiki Beach. We had the opportunity to assess their organizational structure, governance, faculty development, and so forth. And it was great because we had recently gone through those same processes at NDU. The team was made up of others from within the joint staff, and I was the only representative from NDU. We worked the typical hours and took an hour for lunch, and for those with experience with these types of evaluations, the facility likes to have defined hours, and the lunch hour was a great time for them to take a breather from us infiltrating their program, even though our evaluation wasn't for any punitive or concerned issues, and rather a routine evaluation required by the joint staff. So during that hour, it was free time for the team. On one of the days, I had a plan. I went back to the hotel from the center that was just a 5 or 7 minute walk. I got to my room, changed, and went to the beach for a half hour. Then I took a quick shower and got back to the center well within the hour. Now, some of my colleagues asked me where I was because we would often go to lunch together. I just said that when in Rome, do as the Romans do, and I felt I at least once had to go to the beach during lunch because we're in such a beautiful and, in fairness, a beachy type place. Another great experience when I got an opportunity to go back to Korea. I was asked to be a visiting professor at the Korea National Defense University. Having been stationed in Korea as a lieutenant in the late 1980s, to get back more than 20 years later was great. The Korea National Defense University is in Seoul, and unlike when I was stationed there, I would be immersed into the Korean culture without that American military base to fall back on. I had a room on the campus, and most of the classes at KNDU are taught in English, so my barely remembered Korean wasn't a problem. Well, it wasn't a problem in class. In addition to teaching a couple national security sessions, I also delivered lectures on leadership and organizational communications, which is what I was teaching at UMUC, and so I adapted some of those courses there at NDU. I was also asked to help them with a review of some of their materials with regard to ensuring the English translations were proper. And, well, even though that certainly was not part of the deal, I was very happy to help. Unlike being on an American military base, the biggest challenge were meals. Now, I love Korean food. Well, I love most Korean food. What I wasn't used to was that breakfast in Korea is like any other meal during the day, and it took a little getting used to that I was going to have rice and kimchi and whatever for breakfast. Luckily, I had access to a driver, and I took advantage to get out and about after hours and on weekends the best I could. We did make one trip to the commissary on the U.S. Army post, Yongsan, and I got a few breakfasty type items for the mornings. Going back to Korea, at this point past my time in Osan was very interesting. Smoking was far less prevalent due to a couple of national campaigns to curtail smoking in the country, and the city was more and more modern than it had been before. I really shouldn't say modern. I probably should more use the term Western, because by this point, Korea had become an economic powerhouse, and the standard of living, certainly among those in the cities, was far improved. I didn't have the opportunity to get out much beyond Seoul during this trip. Unlike most trips that senior leaders go on, we would make a visit to the protocol office and bring NDU personalized gift items for exchange that would typically occur, and they would be based on who you were and who you were meeting with. So there's always an expectation to receive gifts, and on the American side, there are very specific rules about value and disposition of the gifts on return to the United States. We had already done our gift exchange, and as it would turn out, I was just about to leave KNDU for the airport, and my host sponsor ran out to see me off. He hands me yet another gift, and he says, "This is for you." It was two booklets of Korean stamps. I could tell that this was definitely outside the value issue and figured a way to excuse myself to call the protocol office. What do I do? Do I accept it? Refuse it? I wasn't really sure, and it was one of my first times going overseas representing NDU. I couldn't get a hold of anyone, so I decided it would be disrespectful not to accept it, and that's what I did. When I got back to Washington, I showed the protocol office this gift, and they said there was no way to determine its value, and they had no use for it, and put it in the incidental pot, and I was allowed to keep it. As you know, it's always better to ask. Speaking of protocol, we got a new protocol officer at some point whose experience was outside of the military. And while that sounds a little curious, all I know was that she and I connected and we became good friends. She would often come to my office with a protocol issue with seating, flags, or whatever, so I was happy to take her under my wing and help her with learning military protocol. NDU was growing within the components as well as new programs. While the primary mission remained the National War College and ICAF, the other programs were significant in meeting the mission in support of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and DoD overall. One example was within ERMC. ERMC was responsible for educating leaders across a wider grade span in the areas of informational technology, and I can only imagine how much that may have also grown since my time at NDU two decades later. One of their very interesting courses was a course on hacking. This was curious to me because who figured that they would have a course on how to hack? A number of foreign entities attempt to hack into the defense systems every day, and this course was designed to help students learn how to counter these attacks, and to do so, they have to learn how hackers work. I had a chance to get a look at this course, and it was really incredible. And while I definitely lacked the technical know-how of what they did, talking to the teachers of the program was really interesting, and it was just one example across the several components of the organization. When General Dunn came on board, one of his focus areas was to look beyond educating colonels for more strategic levels of leadership. There is a capstone course that exists for newly promoted brigadier generals and rear admirals. It was a highly respected course and one that the students actually really liked. The next step, though, was to develop a more senior course that we called Pinnacle for three-star generals and admirals. This was always a challenge when developing courses and then thinking about who would teach courses to these already very senior leaders. My role was to contribute to thinking about the overall curriculum, length, and structure of the course. I did a check, and the course is still in operation today and taught by retired 3- and 4-star general officers and other high-level guest speakers, which is what we expected would happen. I recall one guest speaker on the early side of the course being former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. That was a great benefit of being at NDU. When there were special speakers of major national prominence, occasionally, staff members would get a valued seat in the auditorium, and since I worked in academic affairs, that was a little bit easier for us. The other advantage of being an NDU was that since it's a federal institution and its own prominence in the development of senior leaders, these speakers would often command high speaker fees and would waive them for NDU. And of course, if you're a federal employee, as some of them were, being in the cabinet, in Congress, or military officers, then they're free anyway. After being accredited, we also began offering honorary degrees to influential speakers at commencement as well. And again, a treasured benefit of speaking at NDU's commencement. As you can see, being at NDU during this period was very interesting. Remember that we're also at war. Enduring freedom was still growing at countries other than in the Middle East, and in 2003 was that famed speech by Secretary Colin Powell at the UN. And NDU was frequently being called on across many of the components for advice and assistance to the Pentagon, the White House, and a number of non-governmental organizations. And our office was in part responsible for shepherding some of these requests. With that, there are questions about the need of some of the students' status. There would be requests for students to be allowed to leave early, and these were coming from the highest levels of command. Our office would be consulted on the impact from an academic standpoint. While we would make our recommendations, there would be pressure to release students. We didn't. The earliest that a student could leave was after completion of the academic program and just ahead of graduation. We also relied on the precedence when, during times of conflict, where academy graduates would be considered to be commissioned early to meet the wartime mission, and they weren't. Just as during other wars, even though they weren't accredited, the National War College never released students because of conflict. And while there is argument on both sides, the long view must take precedence. It was very interesting to be in these conversations, and while the argument certainly had merit, our position we took always was the long view. Interestingly, since I was in the conversations and part of the decision-making process, there were some that really questioned whether I should be there or not, since I was still only a lieutenant colonel. And my peers were all full colonels and above. And that would bring about some challenges, and I'll talk about those next week. One of the things that I had to think about was my own professional military education. As a lieutenant colonel, there was talk about me attending the National War College at some time during my tenure. And since, as you might expect, there can be some wiggle room to get someone in outside the normal selection process. It's not done often, and at the time, among the non-faculty staff at NDU, I was one of the more senior officers simply because there weren't that many. Regardless, I would have to be prepared, and so I enrolled in the Air War College by correspondence. This is not a fun course to take by correspondence. Alas, it is part of being a good military citizen and necessary for professional development and promotion. At the end of the course, unlike the Air Command and Staff College that you complete as a captain or a junior major, there is a paper that is graded at the end of the program. There is also an incredible amount of reading, and since I'm not a great reader, thank goodness I learned how to speed read a long time ago. Fortunately, I finally succeeded and got my diploma and met my requirements. In addition to my professional military education, I was also working to keep up with my professional work in higher education as well. I was writing book reviews for scholarly work, and I presented at a couple of refereed professional conferences, and with William & Mary as well as NDU's name behind me, that was a great way to keep up in the field of education. So I guess this is a good breaking point for this episode. Next week, there are some more exciting trips that I take, to include one where I represent the chairman at a conference And how that happened is a little bit crazy. The energy crisis of the 2000s comes, and I find a way around the high price of gas. So there is more to come, and I hope that you will continue to join us next week. I hope you're surviving the crazy weather that we're having, at least certainly in the United States, and getting ready for the holiday season. Have a great week, and I'll see you then.